Welcome to Quinn's Empowerment Hour on the BBS Radio Network, hosted by Quinn Lay Erickson, psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. Quinn's experience as a blind woman, a boat person from Vietnam, and a refugee has driven her to realize her dream to help you to become the best that you can be. So join Quinn every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, for an hour of insight and inspiration for your heart, your spirit, and your soul. Good evening, this is Quinn's Empowerment Hour with Quinn Lay Erickson. I'm very happy that you joined me tonight, and tonight I'm hoping to share with you something hopefully closer to your heart, something that you can use at some point in your life. I'm hoping to talk about how we can find meaning in tragic situations, how we can make sense, of unpleasant situations and experiences in our lives. What happens when we feel like we are a helpless victim, or we feel like we facing situations that are hopeless, experiences that seemingly hopeless and also impossible to ever change, or dealing with people who very tough to change, they seem very difficult. And so Viktor Frankl, who was a psychiatrist and who was also a Holocaust survivor, he talked about attitude, the attitude of making a choice that even though somebody can seem to take away our physical freedom and can even limit our emotional freedom, but no one can truly take away your own freedom without you letting them to do so. And so he talked about how when things around us, when we cannot change, what we can do is we can change ourselves. We can change our attitude. And so today I'm hoping to talk to you about that by sharing you some of my personal experiences as well as some of the experiences of other people that I've known about. So I think one of the first things that is very helpful and very important in situations that seemingly very hopeless is having the faith. Either have faith in God or in a spiritual being or spiritual figure that you have, or have faith in yourself that you find your way out of it. This is even more helpful when you look back at past situations, how you overcame challenges in your life. If your life has been relatively smooth sailing, it might be a little bit tricky at first for you. Because when things have gone very smooth in the past, it's very difficult to think about how you have handled unpleasant experiences in the past. And so I think in that sense, really allow that opportunity to turn inside yourself and ask yourself, what can I learn from this situation? What is the lesson here? What is it trying to teach me? What can I learn from this? How can I make sense of this? And sometimes, the answers, it's difficult to find the answers right away. And I would say, keep asking and having faith that something is going to turn out. Because I really believe that the only way that situations remain hopeless is for us to feel hopeless inside. And so when we can change that, when we can change ourselves to have hope, despite how hopeless the situation is, that can often help to turn the situation around. So for example, when I was in the refugee camp with my family for 4 years, you know, day after day, my mom would experience people leaving the camp because they were qualified to do so. And day after day, or, you know, every time a group of people left the camp, she would feel very hopeless because it just seems like something like that wasn't available for us. And yet she had hope. She had hope that we would get out there eventually, that people could volunteer to go back to Vietnam because there was that option. You could volunteer to go back to Vietnam. But she knew that was not a way out. So she hung in there and hoping that one day our family would be able to leave Vietnam. In the refugee camp, every family had to go through a screening process in order to be determined whether they would be qualified as refugees in order to come to a Western country like Canada, US, Britain, so on. And so she went through that process, and in order to be qualified as refugees, often it was more of a political reason that they had to deem that we were politically struggling in Vietnam. And my mom couldn't quite prove that. Her reasons to leave Vietnam were mostly personal, that she wanted a better future for our family, especially for me as a person without sight, especially for her blind daughter. And so her rationale was seen as not political. And so they told her that she would not be qualified. And so I remember on that day, my mom took me to that, took me along with her, you know, to speak with the official. And they told her that, you know, go back to Vietnam because you're not qualified as refugees. And she recalled that she was devastated. She was absolutely devastated because we risked everything, including our lives, to leave Vietnam. If you listen to one of my earlier podcasts back in September, I talked about our boat journey and leaving Vietnam. So, you know, during that journey, we encountered pirates. We got lost in the sea for 10 days. We witnessed the pirates robbing us. We witnessed them sexually assault some woman. And most of all, you know, a lot of us, we sold things that we had back in Vietnam, including sometimes our houses, perhaps. We left behind the family. And with communism, you know, when people return to Vietnam, usually they're not treated well, because they would be seen as traitors, right? So she, to think about a possibility, it was very hopeless for her. And I remember that when, so we were walking home in the heat and it was extremely hot. If you could imagine, you know, 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was probably about 40 degrees Celsius outside, and we had to walk home. It would have been about 3 or 4 kilometers. So my mom was hopeless, and a friend of her actually offered to take her to take us, my mom and I, to a restaurant, and she would treat us to a bowl of soup or some kind of nice dish. And you know, being hungry over there, it would have been an incredible offer, right? Because when you're hungry, if somebody offered to take you to a restaurant, it would be wonderful. But because she was so hopeless, she said, no, thank you. I just don't feel like eating. Because her her dream was shattered, right? And so we continued to walk home, and then I started to become sick. I started to have a heat stroke, and my mom started to panic. What am I going to do? My daughter's getting sick. We have quite a long way home. So she saw a car passing by, and she decided to wave at the car to hitchhike. And in the refugee camp, typically cars belong to important officials. So actually the implicit understanding was that, you know, they wouldn't give us a ride, right? Otherwise they would be busy giving rides to refugees. So, and they were also there was also a hierarchy of power too. They wouldn't be in the car with us as refugees. So, but my mom, she panicked, so she waved at the car anyway, and actually the car continued to drive on. And but I guess a few minutes later the car actually turned around and stopped for us. So excitedly my mom said, "Okay, Quinn, let's go in." They stopped for us. So, you know, coming from Vietnam and growing up there, I had never been in a car before. So when I got in the car, I was sort of awkward. And so I hit my head, you know, I guess somewhere on the door or the roof of the car or something, I can't remember. And then my mom suddenly realized that we were in the car of a very important official. He was the head of the United Nations representatives, because at the time they had lawyers or representatives from the United Nations being there to screen for refugees, to screen the refugees, right? So my mom told me, she kind of whispered to me and she said, you know, this is, I even remember the guy's name, the man's name. His name was Peter, Peter's car, and he's like the head of the department. And so I remember that my mom often told me, you know, to take advantage of opportunities, because you never know how an experience or an opportunity can change your life, can turn your life around completely. And, you know, often she would teach me very basic English, because even up until today, my mom doesn't really speak English so much. But at the time, she taught me some broken English. You know, she said, if one day you meet somebody who could speak English, just talk to them, because you never know, they could help you. So I decided to take advantage of the opportunity, you know, and I turned to the man, and I was like 12 at the time, so I was still very young. And remember, I was very different back then. I was very shy, extremely shy, because growing up in my culture, I was taught to keep quiet. You know, a good girl is a girl who's a quiet, or good child even, is to be seen, not to be heard, unless they are being asked. And yet something in my heart told me I got to do something about this. So I turned to the man and I said in my broken English, and I said, "I'm blind, please help me." So I meant to say, "I'm blind, please help me." And fortunately, there was also a translator there too. So the man, you know, asked for our ID, asked who we were, our names, and we actually didn't think too much of it, you know, because even though I tried, but often those things, you know, we just thought that he was just being friendly. We didn't really think too much of it. And frankly, my mom was too hopeless, too sort of too much in her own world at the time to really think much of it. And I was too young to think of anything of it. But that was the turning point for us, because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here today. The next day, he called us up and he redid the screening process for us, and he overturned the decision that we were qualified to go to the qualified as refugees. He made that decision within 2 days, and that was a miracle for us. Something like that never happened before. And we thought, oh, this is great, so we're going to go to Canada or somewhere soon. Well, and yet there was another challenge for us. Steve Jobs said, you know, often when things happen unpleasant or very challenging, often at the time it just seemed very sad and discouraging. And often when you look back later, you can connect the dots. The thing though is that when we're in that situation, it's difficult to see the connecting dots. So hopefully you can remember in the future that when something bad happened, that you can always think about or have the faith that these things will help to connect the dots in the future. And so, like I said, that man, he was extremely helpful. He was a Dutch man. And he introduced us to a group of Dutch people because he wanted us to go to Holland. He thought that Holland would be best for us. And so, at that time, there was a group of Dutch people who came to the refugee camp in the hope of sponsoring some refugees. So he introduced us to them. And I remember I talked with a Dutch doctor. He was extremely friendly, and he let me, you know, touch his hands. And I remember I was telling him how hairy his hands were, you know, just being a very innocent child, right? And they were quite fond of us. They wanted to accept us to go to Holland. So we were very excited. Well, the problem was Peter, the Dutch lawyer, he really upset another Indonesian lady. She was responsible for matching people up with you know, the right country, so to speak, or the right group of sponsors. She was responsible for matching refugees with sponsors. And she saw that, you know, he stepped onto her territory, and she didn't like that. But, you know, rather than talking to him about it or being mad, she was mad at us. So we were sort of her scapegoat, and she didn't like us. So she said, you know, at the time we had relatives in Canada. So she said, you have relatives in Canada. You have to go to Canada. But the problem was, our relatives were barely immigrants within a year in Canada. So as new immigrants, they were not qualified to be sponsors. They had jobs, but not stable enough. They didn't have enough income. And so we were stuck because we had relatives in Canada, so we had to go to Canada, but our relatives couldn't sponsor us. And so she put our file at the bottom of the stack. And even though we were qualified as refugees to go to another Western country, but because she buried our file at the bottom, so we waited for another 2 years. And so again, it seemed very hopeless. You know, every week when they called up people to be sponsored and then people to leave the camp, oh, we were so hopeful every time, and every time we became hopeless. And so eventually, that lady, she got displaced, and another lady came on to the show, and she called us up. And I remember the day before we knew that she would call us up, my mom said to me, you know, talk to the lady again. She always, somehow my mom had this idea that I had the ability to talk to people, to get that compassion. And when you're in a very challenging situation, when things seem hopeless, you would think about anything you can think of to change the situation. And so my mom saw me as the key of change, and often she would encourage me to talk to people. You know, so when I met with that lady, I told her, we had a translator, but I told her that, you know, we've been really struggling, we've been waiting for 4 years now, and we couldn't go to Canada. And so she was able to find a sponsor for us. Actually, it was the Salvation Army. So my point to tell you this story is that even though we were very hopeless at the time that we couldn't go to Holland, but looking back now, I am very happy that I'm in Canada. Or I'm happy that I'm in North America. I'm happy that we ended up being in a country that we could speak English, because being in Holland, it would have been way more challenging. There are way less immigrants, less Asians in Holland. And also, you know, I would have to learn to speak a different language. For me, I love to speak English. So for me, that's a wonderful thing. And my family feels the same way too. So at the time, you know, we were very upset at the lady for doing this to us. We were very angry towards her. And yet, little did she know that, you know, she did a favor for us unknowingly. So have you ever been in a situation that you felt very hopeless? You know, what helped you to get through to that kind of situation? So I talked about faith and attitude. Another thing that I think is very important is finding meaning in the situation. Asking yourself these questions. What is the lesson behind here? What is it trying to teach me? What can I learn from this? And sometimes the answer is very difficult to find. But if you keep asking, eventually you get the answer. You know, I remember a while ago, I was in a job that I was very unhappy. You know, the place was to empower women. But yet, staff, employees in that job, we felt very disempowered because our superior was very controlling. And I've been very fortunate in the sense that I've always felt empowered in my workplace. You know, maybe not perfect, but I always seem to have relatively good connections with my managers, with my coworkers. And in this particular workplace, I felt very disempowered. And empowerment is a very, very important value in my life. I worked very hard to become empowered in my life. Especially coming from Vietnam, where people who are blind seen as, you know, the voiceless, the helpless, the useless. And so I worked really hard to change that. Even in Canada, in North America, lots of people who are blind are unemployed or being marginalized here. So I worked hard to achieve a degree. I worked hard to become a psychotherapist. And so to me, empowerment is extremely important. And when I feel disempowered on a regular basis, I ask myself, what is the lesson here? What is it trying to teach me? And I realized a few things. One was that I realized what it felt like to be disempowered. It was one thing when I felt disempowered in Vietnam, when I was in a refugee camp, when I first came to Canada, when my English was still you know, pretty basic, and when I was trying to get my education. But it's another thing to feel disempowered when you are supposedly in a position that gives you empowerment. I felt disempowered, and I thought I understood what it feels like to be disempowered, to be controlled by somebody. And so it helped me to have more compassion towards my clients, towards the women that I was working with. Because often in Canada, you know, when things are relatively smooth, and so a lot of time it's easy to say, oh, you know, those are first world problems, right? And yet it really opened my eyes to what it's like, you know, to be controlled, to not feel satisfied in the workplace. So that was one lesson for me. Another lesson for me was, I asked myself, what could I do in this situation? And so I talked with her. First, I talked with her one-on-one, and it seemed to work for a few weeks, but then it went back to the way it was. And then months went by, and then, you know, she did quite a few things, so I was very unhappy, so I talked to her again. But this time, I invited a union in, and I was very serious. I said, look, this would have to change, because either I'm going to resign, which I don't want to resign yet, because I moved to a different town. You know, I relocated to take this job, so I don't want to resign. I don't want to resign. But I am seriously considering, you know, taking a stress leave, because I have to reevaluate whether this workplace is helpful for me or not. Well, before I said that, at first she didn't take any responsibility. She became defensive, and I tried to explain to her from an using I statement, right? Like, I feel very uncomfortable when you do this, or I don't appreciate being treated like such, or, you know, it's very important to me to feel empowered in the workplace. If you're unhappy with me about something, go and talk to me about it. Because I don't appreciate the treatment. And so she would become defensive. Well, that's my job, you know, I'm the boss. And I said, you know, I've dealt with professors, with managers, and I haven't experienced this before. So I know what it could be like, and it doesn't have to be this way. And so she remained defensive. And so I guess finally what I said to her, like I said earlier, that, you know, unless this doesn't change, I'm really thinking of either resigning or taking a stress leave. And I think that's when she was, she realized how serious I was. Because I think initially she thought that I was desperate for the job. That, you know, it's a small town, it's difficult to find a full-time permanent job. But when she realized that I was ready to leave, that's when she was willing to change. So it taught me the lesson of not being so desperate, so attached about something. That when something is unpleasant, disempowering, that it's important to think about letting it go. Because it's when you have a detachment to something, that's when things can turn around. So she was willing to make some changes, and from that point on it stopped. But another lesson I got from that was, it actually, because I felt stressed and depressed during several months, I asked myself, you know, is this the kind of job I want to be in? Because even though I'm a psychotherapist, but there are different aspects of counseling, there are different populations that I could work with. And deep in my heart, I felt like there was more to me. I felt like this wasn't a very satisfying position for me. So it's not just the boss. There was also other things going on in the sense that I felt unfulfilled. I remember listening to a speech by Steve Jobs. He did the speech during a graduation ceremony at, I believe it was Oxford University in 2005. And he said, you know, when you wake up 3 days in a row or, you know, many days, and you ask yourself, if this is my last day to live, would I do the same thing that I would? And so I remember that question and I asked myself that during those several months. And the answer kept coming up is no, I wanted to do something else. I wanted to have a greater impact. I wanted to have more financial security in my life. I wanted to find a workplace that has, you know, perhaps more balance, because it was difficult to work in a workplace with only women. You know, I needed feminine as well as masculine energy in my life. So I decided to, after several months, you know, I decided to let go of the position. And at the time, I wasn't sure about whether I could get the position that I'm in right now at this time. It wasn't very clear. And yet, I said to myself, I wasn't happy. I would have to do something about it, you know. And so I talked to my husband about it. And at first, it was difficult for him to understand because, you know, he's the kind of person that security and predictability is very important to him. And to let go of a job before you know for sure that you could get another job, to him, it's just anxiety provoking. But I talked to him how important it is for me to feel happy in life. How important it is, because in, you know, being, dealing with blindness, coming to, you know, a totally different country from Vietnam, I've dealt with a lot of hardships in my life, and to me, happiness is very important, even if I'm poor. And yet, going back to that point that I said earlier, I had faith in myself that I would find something, even though I knew it would be difficult to do so in a small town, but I had faith because since I graduated in 2010, I have always been employed. I haven't been unemployed at all. You know, and I saw that as before I could find a new job, it would be an opportunity for me to take a break because I was feeling unfulfilled in my other job, that I also started to feel sort of burned out, and I wasn't as exciting, as inspired about counseling as I could be. So I knew that was important to me, and I took that risk. Because I remember in my past, whenever I was truly ready to let go of something, that's when something new would come to me. And so I took the risk and I let it go. And I resigned from the position. And like I said, at the time, I wasn't sure when I would get the next job and even where. But I had faith. I had faith that things would turn out to be okay. Maybe later, maybe not as soon, but I had faith in myself. And for me, I had also had faith in God that He would not abandon me. And so within 2 weeks of resigning, I was enjoying my break actually. You know, I got the confirmation that they would hire me in a new position. And it has been extremely rewarding for me in this current position. You know, I have greater financial security, way more than I could ever expect at the time. I work with men and women as co-workers, and I learn a lot from them. So, and also the clients I have, I feel a lot of, I often feel a lot of hope, very satisfying for me. And so I feel like it was one of the best decisions that I've made, even though it didn't seem at the time, you know. Family members thought that it was too risky for me to let go of a job, or friends thought that too risky. My husband thought so too, but he knew that happiness or feeling fulfillment in a job is extremely important to me. And so when you're in your career right now, you know, if you're unhappy, ask yourself, why are you feeling unhappy? Why are you feeling unfulfilled? What can you do? Can you change? Can you make changes in yourself in order to change people around you in your workplace? If not, can you change your career? Even though as scary as it is, as risky as it is, but life is too short. You know, if you wake up 10, 20 years from now, you still work in the same job and you feel unfulfilled, but you turn off that that feeling in order to get through things. And it is tough. It is tough to do because often we have financial obligations, we have family obligations, family responsibilities. So it is not easy, right? So it doesn't have to mean that you have to quit your job right now even. It might mean that to allow yourself to be open to the possibility of having a new job. To tell yourself that you deserve better, whether it be financially, whether it be emotionally, you deserve better. So it might be that you don't have to quit the job right now, but keep looking. Because you find something. There's a saying in the Bible that, you know, keep knocking and a door will open for you eventually. Keep looking. Well, this one is not in the Bible, I don't think. But for me, keep looking and you find something. Keep asking. You find somebody who can help you. You know, I've worked with different clients who have faced incredible challenges in their lives and would often encounter experiences that's so difficult to make sense of. I used to work in a palliative and hospice care setting, and quite a number of my clients lost their loved ones to cancer, to sickness, and it was extremely hard for them, very painful, particularly if they had very good relationships with the person. And yet, those clients eventually, they were able to find meaning in the losses. And such meaning could be something like they learned to appreciate and cherish the ones who are still living. Or they learn how to be on their own again. You know, some people who have been with their spouses for years and years and even decades. So it was an opportunity for them to learn to be independent again, to learn to explore a new chapter in their lives, or to learn to foster a new sense of self-identity. Because a lot of women, you know, saw themselves in the shadows of the husband. So being alone now, they learn, you know, what else is about me? Who else am I beside a wife, a mother? Who else could I be? When a mother, you know, lost a child, she was extremely devastated. And yet, I asked her, who else in your life that you can turn your love to? Who else in your life was still alive? And she realized that she still had, you know, two other children to love. And so she decided to turn her love towards the other children. When I used to work at an organization for the blind, I I worked with individuals who lost their sight in their adulthood. And unlike me, who lost my sight when I was two, you know, losing your sight when you're older is much, much harder, because you learn to adjust, you learn to do things all over again without sight, right? I learned to adapt at a very young age, and I continue to learn to adapt, but to a much lesser extent. Whereas people who've lost their sight later on, it just like, if it feels like they fall into a tunnel. Darkness, complete darkness envelops them. And so, you know, a lot of time it wasn't just losing their sight. It also means losing their career, their status, their sense of identity, their empowerment. Sometimes it could mean losing friendships, or worse, it could mean losing a family, like a marriage, a relationship. Because sometimes a husband or a wife cannot handle, you know, the loss of sight of their spouse. So they left for another spouse, for another life, because they said, I didn't sign up for this. And so if you could imagine, it's extremely devastating. But most importantly, they lost a lot. They would lose a lot of self-confidence, a lot of self-esteem. And so they would feel very helpless, very hopeless, depressed, even suicidal. And working with them, you know, I would validate their experience. So listen to them, validate that this is extremely difficult for them. These are the feelings they have, hopelessness, helplessness, grief and loss, right? They have to grieve for the loss of their sight too. They have to come to terms. I have to come to a sense of acceptance, self-acceptance. And eventually, I would help them find meaning behind the sight loss, as difficult as it is. And the meaning the loss of their sight would be different for everyone, right? For someone, it could be learning to be more attuned in their relationships. So in the past, relationships, the means to relationships for them may have been doing things, buying things, you know, basically things outside of them. Now, relationships for them might mean they learn to listen to their loved ones. They learn to attend to their loved ones' feelings, emotions. They learn to show love in more meaningful ways, right? Like sharing music together, sharing experience together, having quality conversations, spending time. A father can learn all those things with his children, because in the past he would be busy with his career, with his stress, with his obligations, responsibilities. Then he had more time to spend with his children after losing his sight. For some other people, it could mean appreciating the finer, the more simple things in life. Like listening to the birds, listening to the waves of the ocean, listening to music, enjoying the smell of certain wonderful things, being in touch with art, right? And for some people, the meaning might be learning to be patient, learning to be compassionate towards oneself. Learning to acknowledge small successes, right? Because when you first lose your sight, you know, the first year or so, it's extremely difficult. So being able to acknowledge and appreciate the small successes that, oh, you know, I'm using my cane, I'm able to get around today, without bumping into things. Or I learned to take a shower instead of an hour like I did initially. I learned to be more efficient, so a shower would take me half an hour or 15 minutes, right? And so those things seem very simple, and yet it's all about the attitude. It's about lowering your expectations so that you're not so hopeless. And yet that's the paradox. It doesn't mean that they have to settle with a helpless, dependent, blind person. It means to accept the blindness and also realizing that as they come, you know, as they become more independent, as they become more efficient, they can achieve things that they would never imagine before. You know, I've known some individuals without sight achieve amazing things after many years of losing their sight. If you remember back in November, I interviewed a lady who won MasterChef of America, right? She was initially, she lost her sight, but initially she also became paralyzed. And yet, after losing her sight, she realized that she still loves cooking. So she would cook and she would blog about her cooking. She blog about, you know, equipment that she would use as a blind person to cook safely in the kitchen. And next thing was that, you know, those people on the MasterChef show found her and thought that it was a joke. So they invited her to come to the show, thinking that, you know, that she's not really blind. And it turned out that, you know, after weeks of competition and being able to excel and compete with hundreds of other people, she won the MasterChef, right? I've known lots of people, you know, they learn to become a counselor, they learn to become a lawyer, or they learn to be an advocate for people who are blind. And so, you know, often as a person, and that's the paradox, as you learn to be compassionate and accepting towards yourself, your limitations, that's when you can start to rise above your limitations. And things take time, you know, it doesn't happen right away. That's difficult to do. You know, right now I work with men struggling with addiction. And so addiction can associate with a lot of shame, hopelessness, helplessness, powerlessness, you know. A lot of the time they have alienated many friends and family members because of perhaps, you know, during the time when they struggle with addiction, they may have lied, they may have basically not being able to be themselves, and, you know, because they're not being true to themselves. Addiction takes away that from a person. It takes away the person's ability or willingness to be true to himself or herself. And so often they would have to lie, they would feel like they have to manipulate, and so often people around them eventually would become fed up with them. Right? And so for these people, I would help them find the meaning of addiction for them, right? It's a time for them to reevaluate their lives. It's a time for them to ask themselves, is this really working for me? Do I want something else more in my life? It's a time for them to make positive changes in their lives. And often it can mean changes in themselves, and those changes can become a ripple effect. Then their family members start to change and their friends start to change as well. Addiction can also be meaningful in the sense that these men learn to be humble. I work in a treatment center, a private treatment center. And so when they come there, they also realize that a lot of people are also in the same boat as well. So they learn to understand suffering. They learn to understand struggles, what it feels like to be helpless, and yet what we can do about it. So yeah, lots of things they can learn from there. And some, you know, when you see YouTube or TED Talks, there are quite a number of people who used to struggle with addictions, and they were able to overcome the addictions. They would speak about their experiences and share with other people to motivate people. Right? So being able to find meaning in challenging situations, in tragedies even, can be very important, because doing that will allow you to have the strength, to have the resiliency to overcome whatever is in front of you. I also talked to, March, I think. I did a show about a photojournalist, and he would often go to all kinds of war zones and countries, and he would take pictures of very tragic situations and conditions. And he said to me, you know, what he tries to convey to people is that even in the midst of tragedy and chaos and violence and suffering, you can always find beauty. Like the image of the woman, you know, being raped repeatedly by this man, and yet when this man was sick and old on the street, homeless, this woman every day would bring a bowl of food to him, because that was her way to find peace, to forgive the man, and not because to condone what he did, not because to say what he did was right, that it was right for him to do that, but it's more for her own sake, that in forgiveness you can find peace. I also remember back in November I interviewed another man who was sexually abused by 9 other men and women back when he was a child in El Salvador. It was Bernardo Herrera. And again, he learned to forgive those people. And he found meaning behind his abuse. He spoke up about sexual abuse for men and how difficult it is to talk about it, and how often the men continue to feel victimized for years, right? He also found meaning in talking out, in so that hopefully people have the awareness to stop child sexual abuse, and the abusers, hopefully they have the awareness to stop doing that too. So, you know, what meaning can you find in a situation in the past that you still have a lot of resentment, you still have a lot of anger, or a lot of confusion? Is there any lesson you can learn from that? Is there any meaning you can make out of that situation? Because the longer we feel resentful, angry, victimized, confused by something, the more those feelings keep us stuck, and those feelings come to define who we are. Whereas if you can find some meaning, if you can find some ways to let go of those feelings, then those feelings no longer define you. So sometimes on Facebook, I saw this post by this man who said, "Am I the only one whose dad is the complete jerk?" And his dad passed away like 20 years ago or something, right? And yet he's still very resentful, very angry towards his dad. It's one thing to acknowledge the bad things that a parent did to you, and to realize that, you know, you were suffering and you were struggling as a child. But it's another thing to remain angry, resentful, despiteful towards a person Because really, in the end, it doesn't hurt that person. It only hurts you, the person who is being resentful, the person who is being angry. Right? So you, by being angry, by being resentful, hateful, all those things, you continue to let those feelings run your life. You continue to let those feelings define who you are. You continue to let the past define your future. So why don't you find ways to let the past refine your future instead of define your future? So thank you for joining me tonight, and thank you for listening to me. I hope that you can find something useful in this podcast for you in a meaningful way, in a way that is more true to your heart and to your spirit. I will speak to you again next time. Bye-bye. This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour, hosted by Quinn Leigh Erickson, every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information about Quinn, visit www.quinle.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a beautiful, restful sleep. Good night.